Welcome back to another episode of the Magnus and Marcus podcast on coaching. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Steve. Back to give the people what they want.
That's right. Thanks for the feedback. I know we both got a couple tweets and messages and stuff. It's always cool to hear that people actually are listening to what we're saying, which is kind of surreal. But yeah, keep it coming. Anything's appreciated. So this week is a topic that I think both of us are really interested in, and I think could go a lot of different ways, but I'll let you start it off. And the topic we basically wanted to cover was kind of a mixture of deciding when, where, and how to back off, and kind of branching into self-importance, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of times we as coaches, we seem to think we have the secret sauce, like a special ingredient that's okay. You know, this workout or these workouts and these series of, you know, reps or with this amount of rest or these speeds, this is going to be the deciding factor. This is going to be the thing that's going to propel these athletes to greatness. You know, I'm always reminded of Kung Fu Panda, where the, you know, the father of the panda, who played by Jack Black, you know, he's a soup person, and there's this quote-unquote secret ingredient to the soup, and then he, you know, later on in the movie, spoiler here, tells, you know, the panda, there is no secret ingredient, there's just the perception of the secret ingredient. That's what makes it special. So, you know, the same thing happens here. I think sometimes we get a little too, you know, egotistical about workouts, and we don't realize, like, there's this big global perspective about things we've talked about before in the pod, you know, from what's happening in the other 21 hours in the day, what's happening day to day, you know, week to week, month to month. And, you know, really, the emphasis is on consistency trumps everything. And it's just reminding people, especially athletes, too, that when they've been consistent for a large block of time, they have more leverage and ability to be, to take a little bit more time away and not have to rev it up. I mean, a good example is, you know, a young lady that I work with here, Pauline Sage, she has been really consistent for about 8 months, like the biggest block of, you know, consistent training she's ever had. You know, she stepped wrong coming off, like, her bike or something, or coming off her bike, slamming on her brakes, and kind of twisted a little bit, tweaked her hip, and really hasn't been running much for 2 weeks going into her conference meet. And, you know, she was real worried that her fitness was going to magically disappear. You know, we just said, hey, don't worry. We just don't want to aggravate this hip thing. You know, this weird trauma. Like, whenever you have a blunt trauma or something unexpected like that happened, you got to step back. And, you know, she goes and she races just fine. You know, racing to what I felt was her ability in our conference meet. And, you know, had a really good end of the indoor season performance. But she needed to be reminded, like, hey, you're not going to just magically lose all this fitness that you've been, you know, accumulating and working on for 8 straight months of uninterrupted training. So don't worry about it. I think sometimes, too, we feel like, oh, my God, I take a day off, or I take a couple days down, or take a rejuvenation week, and all of a sudden I'm going to be back to square one. And, you know, that's not the case. I have to, you know, always remind people, like, most endurance fitness studies have shown, like, there's a half-life of fitness after about three and a half weeks, and that's doing absolutely nothing, sitting on the couch, eating bonbons and Cheetos and watching soap operas all day. So, I mean, the fact that if you're still doing something, whether it's cross-training, you know, on ellipticals now, or in the pool, or still getting your weights in, but you're not doing the actual direct transfer effect of running, doesn't mean you're all of a sudden going to just magically will. So, you know, I think sometimes we have to remember those critical factors about, it's more about doing things week to week consistently rather than just this magic workout, or that if you take a couple days off or a week down or something, it's all just going to magically disappear. So, you know, it's always very sobering and humbling to kind of remember that, especially as we kind of now get into track season, outdoors proper for everyone, and everyone's looking for that magic recipe or that magic workout that's going to put you over the top. And as Steve and I have talked a lot of the pod, you know, we're much more global in our approach rather than just kind of being about this new, you know, get fit quick scheme or get fit quick workout.
Exactly. You know, it's funny. I call it this need for perfection, right? I mean, we're... taking a step back a little bit, is one of the things I see young coaches and young athletes do is they, you know, they come up with this grand plan where every workout's exactly planned out, and they expect to hit every single one of those things. And it's like, this plan is the one thing that we can control, right, as coaches. So we put so much emphasis in it and saying, this is the, this, if we hit this plan, we're going to get to the next level, or we're going to get, you know, win conference, or, you know, make nationals or whatever. And the focus isn't on that plan and being perfect on it. And sometimes as a young coach, what I've seen happen is they get athletes to buy in, which is great. It's great. But when you hit that inevitable snug, you know, where you have to divert and go a different route, or you have to change the workout or take a couple days here or there, it's like the world ends. It's like, oh my God, like, what do we do now? And I think that's kind of what you're talking about. Is a coach, you have an option, right? The athlete, especially if you work with high school or college athletes, and even professional athletes, the athlete's reaction is to freak out, right? If they step off that curb, like your girl, and, you know, have to take 3 or 4 days off or something like that, the athlete's going to freak out. And it's our job as coaches to remind and bring back that global approach, right? And say, hey, you know, it's okay. You're not going to lose fitness. Don't worry about it. You know, if we do X, Y, and Z, you're going to be okay. But as I said, as we've talked about here, I think it's this tendency to put so much emphasis into what we can control workouts, because it's the one thing we have absolute control of. So it becomes this search for that magic workout or that magic recipe, when the reality is yes, there's principles, and we've talked about that, and there's good and bad practices. But there's no magic fixture. Everybody's so different that everybody needs their own unique combination. And if it changes a little bit, it's okay. You know, one of the things I always like to do at the end of the season is look back at my beginning of the year kind of training plan outline, and then look at what we've done, what we actually did. And if I'm getting, you know, 60% of it right, you know, we actually did 60% of what we planned, I'm thinking, dang, man, I did a good job in predicting, because there's that much variability that that happens and occurs. So I guess one of the big lessons that, you know, I've learned as a coach is don't stress it. Like, you're going to meander along the path. It's that global approach that matters.
I think you said something interesting, Steve. It's just perceived control. I think most coaches and most people in America, I mean, it's just Western, you know, North American thing, are control freaks. We think, all right, control all these variables. If we do this, if we structure like that, you know, everything's going to be perfect. I can speak for myself. I have never once had a season, let alone a week, that's gone exactly as I had prescribed it, or as I had predicted it was going to go, you know, from a training module standpoint, for any athlete ever. Because, again, I think that's part of the, you know, being really in tune with your athletes and just being very malleable with what the athletes, you know, show up with on a day-to-day basis. But two, it's also, again, knowing, like, I sometimes feel like we overemphasize our self-importance and this, you know, tendency to control every little variable as coaches. And if someone doesn't do well on me, it's like, oh, well, they didn't do their warm-up perfect. Or, oh, well, they waited 20 minutes to start the 4x4. And it's like, well, everyone else had to deal with it. Why is that, you know, a barrier to that one person's success? Because you couldn't control the 4x4 spokes. So at this time, they warmed up on time, but then they had like a 20-minute delay for whatever reason. So, you know, it's a very Western philosophy. I mean, I've worked with a couple East African athletes, and they have this kind of really relaxed, like, laissez-faire attitude. Like, they know they're fit. They know they're confident in themselves. And if a session doesn't go well, it'll be like, oh, no worries, I'll get it later. You know, oh, I'll come back tomorrow, it's better. I'll be good then. It'll be okay. When I was coaching, helping out Rob Connor at University of Portland for a couple of years there, we had Alfred Kipchumba, who was, you know, greatest distance runner in pilot history, school record holder in the 5K. You know, he won Mount SAC, 10K 1 year, and we had what we called Alf Logic. Alf Logic was, I'll show up, I can't even do a 5:30 mile tempo. or a 5:30 pace tempo for 5 miles, and a month later go in Mount Sac. And you'd be like, oh, it's okay. I'll be fit. It's okay. I'll be ready for the championships. It's okay, coach. It's okay. And because Alf knew how to really get himself prepared, and I think sometimes that's the critical difference, is training, as I always tell my athletes, training is a checklist approach. Training is saying, okay, you got to do your warm-up, your dynamics, your drills, your, you know, these reps at this pace, your cool down, your, you know, post-recovery exercises, you know, your weight room. Okay, you trained perfectly for the day. Here's the gold star. You got it all done. And we have personal trainers. Like, people are just training. What are you training? Well, I'm just training to be in shape. But, you know, the critical difference, I think, between general training and preparation is that you're preparing for a specific task and a specific day and time in mind. So most scholastic athletes are preparing for some sort of scholastic championship, whether it's, you know, your state championship, your conference championship, national championships, whatever. We're preparing, and that, I have to remind people, is much different than training, because it takes on a different type of commitment and a different type of global view. Like, you're preparing to be ready to go on the day. So what happens when, you know, you wake up a little bit under the weather, or your flight got delayed to get to this championship meet and you don't get in until 3 a.m., you know, instead of the 3 p.m. as you had planned? You know, how are you going to respond to that? And if you just live this perfect training checklist existence and practice, because your coach and the athletes have set that up to make that happen, you know, it kind of goes to this, back to this variability or anti-fragile approach, where it's like, well, how are you going to respond when things are, there's a lot of adversity? So sometimes I throw in adversity training or adversity preparation in workouts. Like, yep. All right, hey, we're going to do this, or we're going to come back and we're going to do this. You're not going to feel good, but you got to get it done, because this is mimicking the realities and demands of a conference championship, where you're going to be asked to do a prelim of the 800 and then come back 2 hours later and do a, you know, DMR final, and then come back 2 hours later and do a 4x4 prelim, you know. I mean, we don't sometimes, I feel like, prepare athletes mentally and emotionally as well as we should for the psychological demands of a championship competition, as we do intend to fool ourselves. Well, we take care of the metabolism, if we take care of, you know, the speed, power, output, we take care of the VO2 or VMAX velocity, they'll be set. They'll figure out how to get it done. And so I suggest people really, you know, shift your focus from a training versus a preparation standpoint, because there's a certain amount of intensity in preparation. Like, if you look at real competitors, they're intense people. Like, when a, you know, boxer preparing for a match, they have one person in mind, you know, their next direct opponent. And one thing, you know, we are doing here, like with our college kids at Portland State, is I'm asking them to pick a direct rival, someone in our conference that, you know, is in an event, and that's the person they're ideally preparing to race against at the conference meet. So how good is this guy in the steeplechase? Okay, he's that good. Well, what can he do for 15 and 8? What can you do for the 15 and 8? You know, what's his 5K pair? What's his cross pair? How do you stack up to him? You say you want to beat him, look at all the other variables about what he's displayed for his competency as a racer, and how do you stack up? And sometimes I think, you know, we just lose sight of the fact, well, we just train and train, we'll just show up and we'll just be magically the best because we've done all the best training, versus if you're preparing and you have that person in mind that you're going to go 16 rounds with, then you have to assume that that person is preparing perfectly themselves to go the full 16 and win by a knockout. So you then have to come back as well with your preparation mentally and emotionally as well as physically to prepare for that full 16 rounds and for the knockout punch in that 16 rounds, so you can overcome that perfect opponent. And when you have that in mind, sometimes I've seen the click happen with a lot of athletes who, you know, are workout warriors, but then come, or time trial, you know, experts, but then come the championship race when it really, really matters or really counts, are nowhere to be found.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, you made some really good points there. I think one of the things that really caught on is creating that adversity in practice. My athletes here at the University of Houston, they probably get sick of all the examples I have. But the cool thing is they know not to make excuses and not to bring things up. I mean, this year, so for example, I had Sarah Hall,
run the half marathon, U.S. half marathon champs, and she had a massive PR, ran sub 71. And the day before, I was actually not at our kind of optional shakeout practice because I was driving Sarah around to a doctor because she was really, really sick. So, and then, you know, 2 days later comes out, kills the half marathon, huge PR, after not thinking she was going to be able to go. Well, all my kids saw that. They watched Sarah race the half. They were like, oh my God, like, she, you know, didn't complain. She just got it done. And then after that, it was like, if anyone got sick and still had a race, they just knew, they're like, oh, Sarah did it. We'll be okay. And it just became this like season long story. It's like, oh, Sarah Hall ran a half marathon. And then we have these other stories. Just one more real quick is this one of my athletes, Drayvon Anderson Kappa, who just won a conference in the 800 and 4x4. One time at New York, we were at the Armory Racing a couple of years ago, indoors. His knee was kind of bothering him. He didn't tell us. Well, we knew it was kind of bothering him, but he needed to get a race in. We're like, I'll just warm up and see. So I'm off helping someone else. He's getting ready for his race. He runs his race. He starts out really slow. We're like, what the heck happened? Like, why is he getting out so slow? Long story short, ends up running a near PR in the mile. Pretty good for him now. Then he's a 149 guy. We're thinking, okay, like that was pretty good. He gets done with the race. I was like, hey, Dre, how come you went out so slow? Well, I really wanted to race, but my knee hurt warming up. So I didn't warm up. I just acted like I jumped rope for 5 minutes because that didn't hurt. And then put my spikes on and got on the line. And strides kind of hurt. So I just kind of waited. And it was just this idea of like, that is insane. Like, first off, why didn't you tell me? But second off, like, he pulled it off, no injuries, nothing. And it just became this long running, like, legend joke now that it's like, well, you know, Dre ran a PR in the mile off of jump roping for 5 minutes. So if your race is 20 minutes delayed or if you didn't get the perfect warm up in, like, who cares? Like, you can still do it. So those stories kind of resonate, and I'm sure my athletes get really sick of them. But it just shows that, like, just be ready, put yourself out there and see. And tying back to some of your other thoughts there is our whole theme this indoor season has been kind of like, just go for it. Like in races, all indoors, just go for it. Put yourself in a position to do something special and see where your limit is. And it's not saying like, go do something stupid, right? But it's like, let's test some things out. Put yourself in a spot you've never been and see how you react. And then we can work on things around that. I feel like so many Americans, so many Westerners, for lack of a better term, like just kind of stay within their box, see where they're at, and just, you know, are happy with incremental improvements within that box. And it's that whole mindset, like we've talked about before, is it's like, get out of that comfort zone. You don't know where your limit is. You don't know how much you could hurt until we actually see. So, you know, we had several examples of athletes going out crazy hard and hanging on. I'll give two real quick. I mean, we had a kid who, a freshman kid, Rick Hawley, who entered the year with a 9:42 mile PR from high school. And in his first 3K on a bank track, goes out in 4:34, 4:35. Well, he ends up running, you know, 8:35 by the end of the season. The first time he did it, he blew up. But at the conference meet, he did the same thing, went out the same pace and held on to run, you know, 8:34, 8:35, which massive PR. So it's things like that where it's like changing that mindset, you know, shifting things a little bit that I think makes a huge deal.
You know, we have a over tendency to measure things that don't matter, especially in a championship race. Like I've long said, you know, championship races, there should be no time taken, no measurement taken for how far or high someone's jumping or throwing. Like all it should just be is pure who can get to the finish line first, who can jump higher, who can throw further, and that's it. And just measure that from a comparative analysis standpoint rather than worrying about some time or mark. You know, because I think when you get into a championship-type setting, there's too much emphasis What was the time? And there's like this secondary reward. There's this like, oh, well, you know, I got 18th, but I PR'd. No, the whole point of going to a championship is to compete and put yourself out there versus like, well, I didn't want to go out too hard because, you know, I want to try to PR, but you got 15th out of 20 and you just gone out and try to, you know, be in the top five and race, you probably got a lot more valuable feedback than being super tentative and get yourself like a half second PR, you know? So, I mean, that'd be one of the greatest fixes in the sport track and field. We just got away with all measurement in championship racing and we just went back to, you know, basically street competition. Like, all right, I'm going to race you from here to here. Let's see who can get there first. You know, there's no time, no mark. It's just pure competition. And, I mean, sometimes we lack preparing for that by trying to control all these variables. Again, this overemphasis on, well, the importance of doing dynamic warm-ups, the difference between static stretching and, you know, before or after. I mean, those things do have some type of impact, but, again, it's not the end-all, be-all. At the end of the day, coaches are teachers. Like, you know, you are blessed if you have this, you know, mathematical genius next Einstein in your classroom, and your goal as a teacher is just to, you know, give them enough resources and, you know, nurturing and encouragement and not screw them up. Same thing with coaches. Like, you know, for every athlete who runs something stellar, you know, runs great, has huge PRs, wins championship, I have a lot of hamburgers on my resume who, you know, don't really run that fast at all. And you get better for them, but they're not going to be that fast. And there's not a whole lot I can do as a coach besides get them to be the best them they can be. But again, it's balancing that perspective and that self-importance as well as, you know, that realization that a lot of what we do as coaches is more about relationships and more about person to person and being there for somebody than it is about knowing all your physiology inside and out, knowing all your metabolic components inside and out, knowing how to sequence everything perfect. That comes with the territory, but sometimes I think there's just overemphasis. Everyone always, you know, asks me, well, what's the best workout for this? Or Joe, just show me the workouts. Just show me the workouts. You know, give me a weak example of workouts. I was like, well, you know, it's really tough to say because it's really, you know, dependent on the athlete. Like we had, you know, a rock star girl for us last year, Sarah Dean, and, you know, she had a weird situation. She had like a flipped disc in her lower lumbar that would actually pinch her sciatic nerve and cut off feeling to her leg if she ran too fast. I mean, she fell off a horse when she was like a junior in high school and just always had, you know, that limitation. We finally figured out, okay, you're pretty good. You can run like 58, 57 high naturally for the quarter. She's always been like a 15-8 type person. But I realized like that wasn't sustainable. So we moved her up to the 10K. And, you know, she ran 34 flat in the 10K in her first year ever trying the event and, you know, was having a lot of success, but also translated to her running a fast 1500, like a 422, which was school record for us. But we didn't train her specifically for the 1500. We just kept her really healthy and just made sure she didn't get hurt. And she'd been running for a year straight at that point. And she was ready, and she had, you know, the PR everything opportunity where she PR'd from everything from the 800 all the way up to the 10K. Just because she had that level of consistency about that relationship. And we knew when to say, well, yeah, your back's kind of hurting you. In fact, now scrap it. Just go pull down. We're not going to deal with it. Like, because her junior year, she wasn't as cautious or as verbal with me about it. And she ran a DMR 400 leg indoors, and we had to sit her out for six months to let her back, you know, and all her nerves and everything kind of realign and make sure nothing was on. So, I mean, she went from her junior year not running for basically all of spring to then the following year after not doing anything running a 422 in like, you know, 34 flat 10K. I mean, that's some range. And the funny thing is she did that in a 5-day period. I mean, this is like a fun story to tell. Maybe one day we just have to have like this story time with Steven, you know, John. But so she goes down, she runs Peyton Jordan. And, you know, she did last the whole time, but she needed a high-level 10K. And we got her in, and, you know, she just basically tempoed a 34 flat 10K. Then that was Sunday night, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Friday night, she comes back in Oregon, runs Oregon Twilight. And I was like, well, how are you feeling now? Oh, that 10K is fine. LCD, it's no big deal. So, okay, well, do you want to run a 15? Oh, yeah, let's do it. And, you know, Sarah goes out and runs a 422. in the 1500 5 days after she ran 3 for a flat 10. You know, the 10 was so new to her, she didn't know how to run it. She ran like a tempo run, so she never really figured out how to race it. But again, it was all her. Like, I always tell people, like, I'm just trying not to screw up, man. I'm just trying to keep her healthy. And anything we did in practice was always geared towards having her be able to run pain-free the next day. You know, so I think, again, I could have rode in, you know, really aggressive workouts. Like, oh, we're going to get her to, like, 32, 30 or something, or get her down to 4, like, you know, 10 or 4, 15, try to really gas her up. But at the end of the day, the main thing for her and for every athlete is just this, you know, consistency over a global perspective. And not to say there's some bad days, you know, and some bad couple of days she had to take down or take off or not do anything because her back flared up. But I was always telling her, like, Sarah, the most important thing is that you can pick up your grandchildren pain-free. I'm not going to do anything here in your early 20s that's going to compromise that life and that mobility in your, you know, 60s and 70s.
Exactly. I mean, and that's what it's all about. I think sometimes we get too focused on this time, like, oh, we got to maximize everybody's abilities and everybody's times and do everything perfect to do it. But that's kind of the end of the day. What we're looking at is people's lives. But I think that story, like, sums up pretty well, like, this need to get away from perfection, and that yes, the workouts are important and all that stuff, but it's not the be all end all, and it's not, you don't need this grand master plan to get it done. You know, as a quick aside story, is that kid I talked about earlier who didn't warm up, Drayvon, his junior year, he ran 158 in the 800 off 3, maybe 4 days a week of running. Because so, similarly, because he had some health issues that kept popping up. So I was like, hey, we can get 3 good days of work in. Why not just get 3 days in and we'll see what happens? And that isn't something that is perfect or optimal or that I'd ever write for any other schedule. But for him, it was what was needed. And he ran really fast off of it and made, you know, first round of NCAAs off it. So it's stuff like that, or it's like, okay, that shows you, like, we don't need this grand master plan. And, you know, one of the things, again, not to make this story time, but when I was a younger coach starting out, like, whenever I'd give presentations at coaching clinics and stuff, you know, all the coaches wanted to know workouts. So I'd be like, all right, sure. I love sharing stuff. So I'm going to give you everything. Like, here's every workout we did, blah, blah, blah. And what I started seeing was, like, people would just try and copy it. Like, they wouldn't have any idea why they were doing it. They'd be like, oh, you know, Steve Magnus gave this to this runner. Like, you know, we should do that. At the time, I think it was coaching some good high school kids. Ryan Doner was state champion 2 mile. And I'm like, ah, oh, Ryan Doner did this. Like, Steve made him do this. Let's do this workout. And then it continued as I got into professional athletes. It's like, ah, oh, you know, this girl did this and she ran low 15 for 5K, so I should do this. And then I started shifting when I gave presentations. So now it's all like process. Like, it's like, all right, I'm going to give you the thinking behind why I'm doing that. And at the first, it was funny. Like, a bunch of coaches would get mad. They're like, ah, you're being secretive. And I'm like, no, I'll give you the workouts. If you want my whole workout plan, you can have it. I'll give it to you after. But you got to understand this process. And it's like, but it was really cool because the ones who get it, like the ones where you can see who it clicks and they just come up and they're like, I get it, man. I get why the decision making that went into that. And that's the key, right? Because it's those decisions we make. You know, it's the decisions you make to say, hey, I got this girl who can't run fast. What can we do with her? Let's try the 10K, right? And let's manage it. It's the decisions we make, like, hey, I got to keep this kid healthy. He's got to run 3 days a week. That aren't explained in coaching manuals, that aren't explained by setting up some awesome workout plan. But those are the things that are the art of coaching and make the difference.
Exactly. And that's the thing, you know, that I think you and I both mentioned, younger coaches, you had to master the fundamentals. You had to have a really deep knowledge of the fundamentals of physiology, the fundamentals of adaptation, supercompensation, periodization. You had to know those things. Like, you know, Lydiard 101, when a new coach gets into coaching and they ask me, well, what's the one book I should read? I go, you know, read, you know, Daniel's, you know, discipline. or training for distance runners. It's, you know, or the runner's formula. It's the best, you know, foundational, elementary. You're not going to screw people up. Good sound bites, book theory. That's not the end all be all, and, you know, that's it, the only Bible, but it's a good starting point. But, I mean, I filled my head with so many of those different books, you know, Peter Coe's Training Distance Runners books, you know, all those track and field news, you know, monthly, you know, distance running, art compilation articles, and just a lot of that stuff. I mean, you know, the lore of running, you name it. But then once I had kind of a grasp of those fundamentals of the process, about how they work and why we're doing what we're doing at different phases and times of the year, then I could step back and completely just kind of scrap it all and say, all right, I need to just coach the person in front of me and get to know this person in front of me as an athlete about what do they need most, where's the clean slate, you know, where's been overworked, what's been too, you know, de-emphasized in their training in the past. And so it's not like people just want, they say the workouts to copy and paste. Say, well, this is it, this is the format, we're going to take this and do that, and you're going to be fine. It's a yes and no process. Like, yes, if they're ready for it, but no, if you don't know why that's happening and what adjustments you can make. You know, so many times, too, right, we have neuroses about hitting the schedule perfect, and if you miss a workout or you miss a run, you got to boom, make it up. And it's like, oh, I missed a workout Tuesday. I was only going to do half of it, so I got to make it up somewhere else. Or I missed, you know, I only could do 40 minutes easy instead of, you know, an hour 40. So I got to make an extra hour up somewhere in the next couple of days. It's like, no, just stop it and move on. That's something bad. We forget it. We missed it. We missed it. It's okay. You know, you can't go back to class on Tuesday, on Thursday, you know, if you miss class that day. Teacher's just moving on with the material. And, you know, we have to adapt that same type of feeling of impermanence, that it's like, okay, we missed it. So what? We just will do and we'll move forward. And we might adjust things, you know, based on missing that and wanting to, you know, kind of supplement things. But we're not going to just directly, you know, replicate or just make up volume, intensity that was missed somewhere else on the road, because you just got to get it in, that mentality.
Oh, man, the making up workout thing is one of my biggest pet peeves. It yeah. is. I can't tell you. Like, I give – now my athletes know, but when the new – it's funny. When the new freshmen come in, they're like, oh, I missed something. Can I make it up, coach?
Right,
can I do it, you know, tomorrow? I'm just like, the face I give them says it all. It's like, oh, come on. Are you serious? But it's, you know, that's normal. Like, that's what you encounter. That's what you get.
Yeah, no, it's
fascinating.
Like,
oh, man.
Up a race, like, oh, my race, or late in the game, coach, can I make up the race? Well, no, the race happened, and you perform. Like, there's nothing we can do. Like, the result's in, bud.
Exactly. It's such, you know, when you step back, it's such a crazy thing to think about, but so many people do it. Mm-hmm. So, oh man. Or the making up mileage. Gosh, I hate that.
Yeah.
Well, I gotta hit my mileage goal. No, just forget it. Like,
last week was supposed to be 70, and I only ran 60. Well, then this week I'll run 80 to make up for not running 70 last week. You know, it's like, no, just, you know, drop it and move forward. That's all I have to do.
Exactly. And I've seen that so many times on the professional level, too. It's like, oh, man, I missed some stuff at the front end of the week. I'll just backload my week with crazy amount of mileage so I hit it. It's like, no, the world doesn't work that way. Like, adaptation doesn't work that way. Just, oh, but
I mean, I think it's sign of, like, the neuroses or A-type, you know, anxiety commitment of a distance runner. And that's why you get out the door every day and train. You have this compulsion to do it. But it's about channeling that nervous energy and having it be a friend rather than be a foe. And, you know, so much of my work sometimes with older, you know, post-collegiate runners is to use that energy as a friend rather than a foe, because that ultimately, you know, leads to the pitfall and, you know, being overstressed or over fatigued or, you know, overworked and injured or sick all the time, because exactly that. I feel like this, you know, arbitrary measure of 7 days is the all-encompassing end-all be-all. I mean, how many people have you heard have gone to 10-day training blocks? Or Paul Radcliffe was in an 8-day cycle. I mean, it's all about whatever you do.
Right.
I mean, kilometers, miles, you know, apples and oranges. So, I mean, yeah, it's always funny.
Exactly.
It is.
I mean, it's. I think you hit a good point there. I like that idea. And let's be honest. I mean, it's like all distance runners to do this sport, you got to be a little bit crazy. And I always say it's like you got to direct that craziness in the right direction so that it's productive. So that like obsessive compulsiveness is like you said, like if it's directed in the right way, you're on point, right? But you can't have it take over and go a little bit in the crazy direction. So, oh man. Well, I think we'll end it there before we go too far into another different direction. But that was a lot of fun, John.
Yeah, it was great, Steve. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Cool. Well, once again, thanks for listening, guys. Hope you guys enjoyed it, and let us know if you have any feedback.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Next week.
All right. See you, John.